Welcome to Theatre Voice, the V&A's archive of conversations with leading theatre practitioners. I'm Tim Bano, editor of Theatre Voice. A few weeks ago, in June 2025, Wales's Theatre Clwyd reopened after a £50 million redevelopment, kicking off a new era with the production of Jonathan Larson's musical Tick Tick Boom. The director of the show and the artistic director of Clwyd is Kate Wasserberg, who took up the role in 2023. It's something of a homecoming for Kate, whose early career as a director was forged at Clwyd when she worked there under artistic director Terry Hands. She then went on to found Wales's first pub theatre, The Other Room, in Cardiff, and then ran out of joint theatre company during a very bruising, very turbulent period, which we talk about in the interview. Now, with audiences flowing back into the building and the theatre itself reaching out more than ever into the local Flintshire community, Kate reflects on the redevelopment and sets out what we can expect from this powerhouse that sits unexpectedly at the top of a hill on the edge of a small Welsh town. Here's Kate Wasserberg.
We had 5 days to turn the front of house, which was handed over to us by the builders, into an audience-ready space. So the entire organisation has been placing fire extinguishers and building flat pack furniture and cleaning while myself and the Tick Tick Boom Company have been squirreling away in the main auditorium making a big musical. And on Monday night we invited audiences back into Theatre Clwyd for the first time, and it was absolutely magic. So we've got our official opening night on Friday. We're having a really lovely time.
So, yeah, because I guess you can't have a new theatre building without a show in it, but it does mean that you've got the double busyness of having a brand new £50 million refurbished building and a huge musical to stage at exactly the same time to kick off the new season. So, I mean, why don't we start with the building? What's been going on at Clwyd for the last few years? Because it's a pretty chunky refurbishment it's been going through.
It is. It's a £50 million redevelopment, which is an enormous investment, nice chunk of public money from brilliant stakeholders like Arts Council Wales and Flintshire County Council, that has then been used to leverage a great deal of private funding. It is future-proofing this really important building for at least the next 50 years. Theatre Clwyd was falling down. I mean, it was mission critical. It was leaking and becoming unsafe. And so it was absolutely necessary. But what it has allowed us to do is bake the values of Theatre Clwyd into the building. So we took it as an opportunity to create health and wellbeing spaces where we can work on our NHS referral partnerships with people living with onset memory loss. We've got spaces for our young people so that they've got their own bit of the building that they can inhabit and make their own work. We've got beautiful new rehearsal rooms that allow us to make theatre in the way that we want to, and we can provide really amazing facilities for our brilliant on-site making team. So we're one of only 4 theatres left in the country that build our own sets and make our own costumes, and we've been able to create bespoke facilities for them on site. It was a necessary thing that became an enormous opportunity. And as bits of the building come online, we're going to be able to move that work from where it currently is in satellites around Mould into the building and create this really amazing hub for the community.
I think that's really interesting, and talking about what that redevelopment has involved, because I think that kind of marks how different we see the role of theatre buildings in communities now from when Clwyd was originally built. I mean, and certainly from when the Victorian stock was built, which was, it was a place of entertainment and kind of that's it. And now these buildings, particularly the ones that are embedded in communities like Clwyd is, have a much, much wider role to play. Is that something that you've seen as you've been working?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think what always attracted me to Clwyd in the first place was that it came out of this 1970s civic idealism. So it doesn't have class baked into it the way those Victorian theatres do. There are no bad seats. It's got a kind of welcoming feel that you can walk in your jeans and not feel like, you know, you're in the wrong place. It sort of welcomes everybody. But for sure, even when I started working at Clwyd, it was very much just a place we made plays, you know, and seeing that role develop has been really joyous. And I remember when I was out of joint and COVID hit, reading about the work that Liam and Tamara were doing, turning Clwyd into a food hub and a wellbeing hub. And it's really extraordinary what has been built at Theatre Clwyd. We've got this referral partnership with social services. We have 500 weekly participants doing our community work, and 40% of them are on bursaries. And lots of those are young people who are also on travel bursaries. And that's all come through social services. So the kind of people we are, young people we are working with, it's not your trad youth theatre, full of middle class kids. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I was one of those middle class kids. But that kind of way of thinking about a theatre as embedded with the NHS, embedded with social services, stopping or mitigating social challenges before they reach other services, criminal justice system, hospitals, is, I think, going to become the norm. And it requires support and it requires funding, because the value is palpable. And we are actually measuring that at the moment. We are working with a local university to study the impact of the work that we are doing. We're very keen on being very tangible and specific about the good that we can do. And I believe that is all driven by being a playhouse that has excellent work on the stage. I think that's the heart of what drives our superpowers that we then share with the community, and it all feeds each other.
And how do you decide on that work then? I mean, particularly for an opening season where I guess the sense of anticipation is bigger in many ways, but even going forward, what is the thought process that goes into putting the work on the stage?
I have a few criteria that I apply. I mean, you know, the first is a sense, is that kind of licks finger and puts finger in the air, you know, that kind of zeitgeist, like what's the story I feel like we need right now?
And yeah.
I mean, Tick, Tick, Boom, I chose very specifically because it is a manifesto for the theatre. It is about choosing to believe that art can change the world and that it's worth dedicating your life to in the face of genuinely shocking, terrifying problems in the world. It's about making the decision that art, theatre, has value within that. So that felt important. I wanted to open with a musical because I wanted to give our audiences a big treat and do something that showed off what the new auditorium could do and kind of go, welcome back, look what your patients bought, you know.
Yeah.
And it stars, of the three of them, two of them are Welsh musical theatre actors, and Welsh talent is absolutely my major headline. I'm always looking at how are we showcasing the very best talent in Wales. The next show we have is made entirely by our young people. It's called On Wednesdays We Wear Pink, and it's all about fashion, and it's got an entirely professional creative team. And that was about saying to them, this is your building, you're the next generation, have at it, we'll give you everything you need and you decide what goes on the stage.
Brilliant.
Then we've got Snake in the Grass, a murdery female-led Alan Akeborn. And that it was really about Frank Goodridge, the director, and going, okay, here's one of our most exciting up-and-coming Welsh directors taking on a really exciting play by a master playwright. We know our audience is in Mold, Love and Murder. It's a co-production with Bolton Octagon, who are great mates of ours, and working in partnership, something we're really passionate about. So that kind of showcases her and gives her a chance to do something a bit different. And then a massive new play by Chris Bennion, who grew up down the road, called Red Rogue of Balor, which is kind of like the Welsh Jerusalem. You know, it's about a thief and a poacher who escapes prison and he runs back to his local pub and the locals protect him and the landowners want him. And is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? It all kind of plays out. It's hilarious, big, ambitious, loads of amazing chunky parts for brilliant, brilliant Welsh actors. North Walian set, which is always something we're kind of interested in because you get a lot of South Wales and less of North Wales in terms of representation. And then a brilliant young Welsh director, Dan Jones, who runs The Other Room, who I think is extraordinary, and I wanted to give him a bit of a bigger palette to play with. And then, you know, we have our much-loved Rock and Roll Panto, which equally, you know, directed by our associate, Dan Lloyd, who's brilliant Welsh talent and has lots and lots of Welsh representation and is actor muso, which our audiences love and really value. So it's about balancing It's about what plays are ready when. We do choose to spend the majority of your subsidy on new work.
Yeah.
Now that is coming through the pipeline. So next year is heavier on new work than this year. But I mean, I've just got a stack of amazing plays that we've commissioned that I need to feed through the building. And, you know, a queue of incredible young Welsh directors that I'm very keen to welcome in. So, yeah, I mean, I could program us 12 times over, honestly, and never look outside of Wales.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, because you haven't actually been at Clwyd that long, and to have a £50 million redevelopment to deal with, as well as programming an inaugural season and then everything beyond, it's quite a lot. So, I mean, when did you arrive at Clwyd?
So I think I officially started in October, a year and a half ago.
Because 18 months is a ridiculously short time for any artistic director to program a season, let alone when the theatre's being rebuilt and all the other work of engagement that you do around that.
Actually, Tim, I felt like it was quite luxurious in terms of programming, because most ADs arrive and it's like, right, what are you doing next season?
Yeah.
What are you doing in 6 months? You know, I didn't have that. I had
So you had the breathing room.
Yeah, I really did. So I programmed the season that we had in the mix, which was our temporary space. And that was easy. And I was working in collaboration with Dan Lloyd and Frank Goodrich, who were associate directors there. And that was easy to do. And then I had loads of time. And actually, I was meeting new writers, new Welsh writers, but also picking up relationships that I had. Obviously, it wasn't going from a standing start. Tamara had commissioned some amazing people, and we had some brilliant projects already in development. So I actually feel like I was really spoiled. And in terms of all the other work that's going on, I mean, the people in our core company are extraordinary, and it's my job to, with Liam, to set the values and keep the ship running. But I absolutely don't do it on my own. So, I feel I've actually been given lots of space and time and support to do this. Obviously, now the rubber is hitting the road and it's going to get busier and busier and busier. But, I got what almost no new AD got. I got thinking time, dream time, space.
That's great. That's a lovely way of looking at it as well. Let's go back to the beginning. When we spoke last time, which was an annoying number of years ago now to think about, because they just slip away, don't they? One of the things I remember is that you grew up near Alton Towers. Is that right?
So true, yeah.
And I remember you saying that's the one thing people remember about where you grew up. It's like, well, I remembered it. So there we go. It worked. So tell me about that. What sort of environment was that? Was it a theatre-going environment? Was it an arts-focused environment?
Like a lot of theatre directors, I'm the child of teachers. And my dad, I think, would have been a theatre director if he'd been born into the next generation, but just kind of, you know, him and my mom just kind of met and got married and had kids. And he became a teacher and realised he really loved it. And I discovered what being a theatre director was because my parents had a bit of a childcare clash because my dad was directing the school play and it was Oh, What a Lovely War. That meant my mum had to take my brothers to five-side football, not her favourite thing. And I absolutely did not want to go to that. And so my dad said I could come. So once I sat in the corner and was quiet, and I sat on this crash mat in the school gym and I watched him direct Oh, What a Lovely War. And after the first rehearsal, I was 6 years old. After the first rehearsal, my mum says I came home and went, that, what dad was doing, I'm going to do that.
Amazing.
So my parents did take me to the theatre. We weren't theatre-y people in terms of the industry. I didn't know anything about that. There wasn't really any provision. My local theatre wasn't interested. I did Amdram. That's what I did. I was like, I left in the chorus just to be around it. So I feel like I had a lot of catching up to do when I kind of got, even after uni, I went to Exeter and did drama. But I think that kind of savvy, I'd never heard of the Royal Court. I'd never heard of the Young Vic. I didn't know these things. And so getting to London, I feel like it took me years to understand things that contemporaries, friends of mine who'd done National Youth Theatre, who'd been introduced to those things, who'd maybe been a bit more clued in. I also just hadn't read many plays, and my arts education, like even a degree in drama, wasn't, it was all very devising focused, which I think was very fashionable at the time. So it was only when I washed up at the Finborough, slightly dispirited, and Neil started giving me plays to read that I reconnected with that. This thing, this is what I do. So I was lucky, really, in like who I found and who found me in that moment. Or I don't know. I probably would be doing it. I every time I've tried to not do it, I've ended up doing it.
When you were doing the degree in drama, did you find that everyone around you kind of knew all those plays and knew the Royal Court and stuff? Or were they similar? I mean, if they were doing a degree in mainly devised stuff, maybe they didn't have that interest.
No, I think Exeter's a really posh uni, but the drama degree wasn't that posh. And I think a lot of us were just finding our way.
Yeah.
For sure, there were some people who were like super clued in and like, probably also just like more academic and worked harder. You know, I needed to be doing it. And I did learn loads, just didn't do a lot of plays and didn't do a lot of like play directing, which really is my thing. So, yeah, thinking back on it, I think we all were just rolling around on the floor and pretending to be trees and learning to be grown-ups, which is probably what I needed.
Yeah. I like that. The twin aims of pretending to be a tree and learning to be a grown-up is all you need from university, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
so, you ended up in London, so you did an MA at Central, I think. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then pitched up at the Finborough for people who don't know it, in kind of central West London, and is run by a guy called Neil McPherson that has been for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And so how did you end up there? And just tell me about that period, because it, as you say, it sounds like it was pretty transformative for you.
It was totally transformative. Yeah, I was a bit broken after the MA at Central, which didn't suit me at all. I definitely was not ready to be in that kind of environment. And again, it was very devising based. And I just felt like I failed and failed all year. And so I was feeling pretty dejected. And I ended up at the Finborough because of the amazing work that the Young Vic did for young directors at that time. So I went to a mixer as part of the Genesis programme. I met a guy who was producing a thing at the Finborough. They were looking for an assistant director. I went, I met them, I got the job. I ended up there. I met Neil, who makes time to meet every artist who comes through that building and get to know them. And we just sort of clicked. I think he liked the way I banged my fist on the table and kind of got passionate about stuff. And he really just invested in me. I mean, he's a real genius. He has a genius for artist development and for dramaturgy. And he taught me so much. And he started getting me to read plays. Obviously, that's the time that James Graham popped up, you know, and we read this play and Neil brought him in and I got to assist on that first play and then ended up directing more of his stuff and working with other wonderful writers. And I lived on a boat on the Thames that was basically a caravan on water, but with a boyfriend at the time, paid very little rent and bills, tutored every evening, taught drama to kids from 9 o'clock on Saturday to 4 o'clock on Sunday. But at that time in the early 2000s, that left me enough money that I could work for free at the Finborough in the day.
God.
And so I did everything. I cleaned the toilets, I painted the stairs, I ran the box office, I read the plays, I answered the phone. And in return, Neil gave me one show a year. And that's how I was able to do it, because I didn't have dad's credit card to put a show on. And so Neil, the Finborough would underwrite a show for me. And that's how I did the work with James. And it's, you know, how I did all my shows and got to learn my craft. And then started picking up bits and bobs of assisting. But I never cracked the like major assisting circuit. I just don't think at the time I matched anyone's idea of a director. And it's really interesting how things have changed.
Yeah.
You know, it's mad to think now, but my accent really did attract a lot of comment.
Who was that comment coming from?
Like directors in interviews, established, privately educated directors who were meeting me to see if they wanted me to be their assistant. There was also a kind of a fashion for a very confrontational interview style that was very embedded, I now know, as an adult, in that kind of Oxford, Cambridge world that I just found upsetting. I just felt like I would go in to meet people and get to know them and they would sneer at me and shout at me and try and catch me out, which I now know was a kind of style that they felt was a valid way of testing someone, but actually you can only survive it if you've been raised in that environment. And where I came from, it put me into a kind of fight or flight, this person's going to punch me kind of world.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, why is this person shouting at me? So I never, ever cracked it. And I felt very much like a kind of like a freak, like a fish out of water. And the only time I was happy was in the rehearsal room. And then I was like, I'm swimming. I know what I'm doing here. But that's what led me to get out of London, is I just thought, whatever this is, I'm not it.
Well, do you think that was a London, like a specifically London attitude, or do you think that was kind of widespread in the theatre world at that time?
I don't know, because I just didn't have enough experience to know. What I do know is that attitudes have moved on everywhere. You know, this is very much, I mean, it's not perfect, you still come across it, but attitudes moved on everywhere. But also certainly I wrote to every regional theatre director I could think of, and Terry was the one that answered, Terry Hans at Theatre Clwyd. And what I do know is that when I got there, I felt like I could be myself and make work. It was very challenging and I learned a lot. I had to get good really quickly. But the way I sounded, who I was, where I went to school, weren't important. And I say this, and it's really important, Tim, to be upfront about this. Like, I'm not working class. My dad was a head teacher. You know, I'm just from Stoke. And like, I'm middle class in a way that is like, my parents owned their house and we had a car, not I went to private school and we had two holidays a year.
Yeah.
Like I'm from a privileged background.
Yeah.
You know, my mum bought my clothes from Topshop. I was a very lucky girl. My house was full of books. I went to the theatre. And yet from a theatre standpoint, from an industry standpoint, I represented class diversity at that point.
Yeah.
And it was hugely about a kind of culture of confrontational showmanship, kind of intellectual jousting. And the whole way I've constructed the way I make work is to take that out of the equation. And
do you think that was reflected in the work that was on the stages at the time as well then?
Yeah, I mean, and I think the directors that really inspired me, that I came to love, they managed to put that stuff to one side. So, you know, Michael Grandage, seeing his work at the Donmar as a young director was transformative for me. And I think he's really kind.
Isn't he just?
You know, he does have that smart, polished thing, but actually that's not what he leads with.
No, and he's got this kind of absolute drive to just help people out, which is an extraordinary attitude to have,
And that is in the work. And I responded to, I remember seeing Kelly Riley in After Miss Julie at the Donmar. Do you remember that?
No, I didn't see it.
And just the love for the characters and the way that he was able to therefore push those characters to this raw, extreme place without ever feeling like he was distancing himself from them. I was like, this is it. This is it. This is what I want to do.
I think that's a mad thing as well, is that this isn't long ago. We're not talking about decades ago here. It's like, you know, it's a ridiculously short amount of time ago for it to have been that different and that kind of entrenched in those class associations.
Yeah.
It's mad. But you did end up in Clwyd. So all those letters, Terry Hans responded and you ended up in Clwyd where he was artistic director. And at what point as well, I think you did the National Theatre Young Directors course as well. Was that around the same time?
That was, it was a few years before, actually. That was a massive set of brilliant coincidences, because I don't think I was quite at the place where you get onto that course.
Right.
But I had written to Katie Mitchell, just the classic, like, come and have a cup of tea with you and desperate to be your assistant sort of thing. And about a year later, she wrote back and she, in amazing classic Katie Mitchell fashion, had just had a baby and was like, I'll use the time to have all those meetings. So I went round to her flat and she had this tiny baby, and I ended up spending like 3 hours with her, and I My mum had always said to me, like, if you go to someone's house and they've just had a baby, make the tea and clean the kitchen. And so I went to make a cup of tea for us both, and I ended up like doing the washing up. And she kind of came in and like looked at me a bit quizzically, and then and leaned on the door jamb. Baby was sleeping, and we just chatted for ages while I like just kind of put things to rights a little bit.
That's a second. Brilliant story.
And I didn't find this out too much later, but she essentially on the back of that phone call, on the back of that meeting, sorry, picked up the phone to Lucy Davies, who ran the National Theatre Studio, and said, would you just meet this girl? I think she's got something. And so I got the meeting, and then I aced the meeting because Lucy was really nice, and it wasn't one of those. I remember feeling like it was the first meeting where I got to actually show what I could do because she wasn't trying to trip me up, and I got on, and that was a game changer. It was a game changer in terms of, I mean, all of the people that we got to meet and work with, and Studio Cluid, which is our big artist development initiative, which we're launching in Wales, is in part inspired by my experience on the Young Directors course and how transformative it was for me. Because one of the big things it gave me was peers. Suddenly, I had all of these incredibly talented young directors who were my mates, and we would go and see each other's dress rehearsals and give each other notes and go to each other's press nights and cheer each other on. And it was an absolute game changer in terms of getting better, helping each other get better. Everyone expected us to be, the culture at the time was that it was incredibly competitive and we should all be trying to tear each other down. And that just wasn't the vibe in my group.
Yeah.
And I'm still friends with them now.
There were some great people in that group as well, weren't there? I mean, if my notes right, was it Polly Findlay and James Grieve in that group? And
yeah, Polly introduced me to my husband. Great mates now. Bronwyn Carr, who was fabulous. Yeah. James Grieve, Tom Creed, Nathan Curry.
It's amazing.
It was a wild group. It was brilliant.
And then, so then, you know, skipping back to a couple of years later and at Cluid, what was it like kind of moving away from London and going into Mould and into Flintshire? And, you know, what did that feel? Very different. I mean, I guess it must have in some ways.
Do you know, I was thinking about this yesterday because I was thinking about the amount of care we're putting around our young directors that we're bringing to us to do the trainee director scheme, and how we think so much about they're away from home. And, you know, and I was just remembering that basically I just rocked up and like, you know, actually the person that looked after me was Terry's PA, Mel. And because I couldn't find a house, I remember I couldn't find anywhere. I went to a letting agent in Mould being like, I want to rent a flat. And they just looked at me like, what are you talking about? And so Mel found me somewhere through the digs list, and she did like kind of mother me a bit. But basically, I just rocked up, got into this little farmhouse, was driving a car for the first time, and just sort of arrived and started working for Terry. Actually, though, I loved it. I remember just straight away, I thought, hang on a minute, I get to live in this beautiful countryside, but go in every day and work in this incredible theatre for one of the best directors in Europe. What? How? And I still feel like that about Cluid. I feel like we've totally cheated the system.
It does sort of feel like that in a way. It is such an extraordinary anomaly, but in just such a brilliant way. And also kind of like an inspirational thing of thinking it can work in any community, you know, it can, it does. So yeah, I mean, it does kind of give you hope. But it does, I mean, I wonder, it does sound like, I never met Terry Hands, but it does sound like he was a pretty extraordinary person as well.
Yeah, he was. He was a complicated person and really scary, like really scary.
Really?
Yeah, but really kind and only scary. Well, scary in two ways. Scary because he found it funny, and scary because he cared desperately about the work. So, you know, he did get cross when he didn't feel that people were striving for excellence. And he was a fierce and exacting mentor, but he was also incredibly kind to me and put a level of faith and trust. And it's something that I remind myself of now when I'm working with young directors, is how much Terry allowed me to make mistakes and make decisions early on so that I could learn from them and put those things on the stage, you know. And then afterwards I'd be like, oh, and he'd go, yes, you shouldn't have done that. So it was completely formative for me, both in terms of the kind of artist I became, but also the kind of mentor I want to be. and the understanding of like paying forward that enormous generosity. His understanding of classical text was something that blew my mind, and the intellectual fierceness and depth of the man was incredibly inspiring. We really got on. We really made each other laugh. I think a lot of the building were quite aghast because he was a scary man, and they were like, what do you need? Go in there and like just have a giggle with him. But I think the fact that I was young, female, it meant there was no butting of heads, you know, and he had mellowed considerably. And I think he was investing in me as the future. And I know that he wanted me to run Clwyd one day. So that's nice.
It's nice happened. Yeah. I remember talking to you as well that you would... It was kind of a toughening up experience, although all those years were. Because I remember you describing... I think you said something like your old people telling me I need to get thicker skin. And Terry said, why do you need thicker skin? That's what makes you so good at it. The fact that you don't.
And that, I mean, he had very thick skin, and it was the appreciation of difference. Like, he kind of brought me in as a counter to himself, and he encouraged me to be sensitive. He was like, no, do it the way you do it. Yeah. You know, we had a joke that was not really a joke, where I said, if you ever shout at me, I will just cry and I won't leave. And then you'll have a crying woman in your office. And he was like, that's genuinely terrifying.
That's brilliant. So how long were you at Clwyd in that period then?
6 years.
6 years, that's a big chunk actually. And then after that, so you stayed in Wales. So tell me what happened next, because it was big step.
Yeah, I mean, Clwyd, that job was like the dream job. I got two shows a year. I read all the new plays.
Yeah.
I had a salary.
Yeah.
I was renting my own little house. I mean, it was ridiculous, you know, from scrabbling around in poverty in London and, you know, and I had all these resources when I made the shows, and I was learning and working with the very best design teams and creatives and actors, and it was just incredible. But at a certain point, I was like, I've topped out what I can do here. And I remember saying to Terry, I'm too old to be someone's Girl Friday. I'm a mom. I'm a grown woman. I have to go and do my own thing. I need to run my own ship or I'll never grow. And so I decided to move. It's so mad every time I say it. It was such a mad thing to do. But we packed up and moved our entire family to Cardiff just because I'd had the idea I should found a pub theatre.
You'd never lived in Cardiff. You didn't have any connection to Cardiff, and you had never founded or run a pub theatre before.
Like, I knew loads of people in Cardiff because Wales is one ecology. Do you know what I mean? And so many of my favourite actors and writers were there creatively. I also knew some people at Arts Council Wales through my work at Clwyd, and sort of gone, is this a thing that might ever be funded? And they were like, ooh, I don't know, maybe. But, you know, I knew them to have the conversation. And so, yeah, we had a toddler, a baby on the way, and we just went. And then I met the incredible Busy Day, who became my executive producer, and we found Porter's Bar, and they jumped on board. And within a year, The Other Room was born and filled with these incredible Welsh artists. And that was... it was really hard and really scary, and it's easy to forget that because also it was so much fun. And I felt like creatively I was on fire. I just felt like I felt at my bravest, at my most intrepid. We just felt like we could do anything. We just felt indestructible, I remember, for those few years. And I was so inspired by these young artists who came and found us and were like, I want to make work here. And, you know, many of them have now gone on to, you know, so Fran started there, Fran Goodridge, Dan Jones, Chelsea, who now runs the Torch in Milford Haven, you know. So, yeah, it was a really cool time and I learned loads. But we never had any money.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other side of the coin. Was it Blasted, your first production?
Yeah.
I mean, which is like, what a statement of intent that is. Like, you know, most pub theatres would do, I don't know, something small, easy to stage or monologue or something, and you're like, no, I'm going to put on this absolutely seminal piece of playwriting, notoriously one of the most difficult things to stage in theatre.
I mean for me that came out of a really specific thing, which was I'd had my second baby and the war in Syria was happening. And I experienced something a lot of new parents experience, which is this feeling that all the babies are your baby. It's a really tangible thing. Like, you genuinely feel like that. And I felt like the war was happening in my backyard. I was like, how am I like putting on kettles and, you know, putting a nappy on my baby while that's happening? I reread Blasted, and like, that's how Sarah Kane felt all the time.
Yeah.
Felt like that all the time, which I can't imagine living with that level of pain all the time, because actually what I had, it passed after the first year and you're able to kind of put those things back into a perspective. But I needed to talk about it. I needed to talk about that feeling. And also, I knew I had the actors. So, you know, Christian Patterson, Louise Collins and Simon Nian, I knew I'd worked with them all extensively. And I knew that I could do a version of Blasted where the headline of almost all my work is, what if this was really happening? That's kind of, I'm not about style. I'm not about concept. I'm just like, what about if minute to minute we just go, let's make this feel like it's actually happening in front of your eyes. I had Max Jones, you know, world-class theatre designer, come and design the opening season in my tiny little pub theatre. I mean, it was extraordinary. I had Dovan Jones, who's done Boys from the Black Stuff and is just like, you know, an amazing, amazing sound designer. So, yeah, it was both deeply heartfelt and very strategic to go, I'm going to pull in every favour I can to put something that looks world-class in this tiny pub theatre. Because that's going to be our MO. And it worked.
It worked brilliantly. And I mean, how did it feel to move from somewhere like Clwyd, which was at that point very well established and had a pretty sure kind of ecosystem, a lot of people working there, to this thing that was essentially you and Busy pulling it together from favours and sellotape?
Yeah, I mean, it felt great, honestly. Like, it was scary and it was tiring and it was stressful. But also the people that found us, you know, I remember Alice, who still does press there now and publicity, is an extraordinary human. Ben Atterbury, who's now literary manager at Bristol Vic, who came in. Like, when we met him, he was doing social media for the pub. And, you know...
That's fantastic.
You know, you just sort of find these incredible people. And,
yeah.
And Nicola Ireland, who was a stage manager I kind of brought with me from Clwyd, who became, you know, our head of stage. And like, we just... I don't know. We just felt like we could do anything. And it was really hard, but it was just super joyous. Painting the walls black with Felix, my baby boy, strapped to me. And, you know, it was a very humane, human, loving place. It was really hard, but it was just, no one could tell us what we couldn't do. And actually, it was a fusion of everything I'd learned at Clwyd and everything I'd learned at the Finborough. That's what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was new for Wales. Wales didn't have a pub there. And so it felt like we were kind of going, look what you can have, look what you can do.
And
people just responded amazingly. I still remember these school kids turning up, and Blasted was like the sixth formers, you know, but Blasted was like the talk of the playground. And they all came.
That is extraordinary. But like, I mean, it does sound to me like you kind of not only thrive on, but kind of seek out these contexts in which you are just incredibly busy all the time. Like, is that a conscious thing?
I don't think it is. I think what it is that I am a house cat. Like, I belong in organisations. I don't like freelancing. I don't walk around with a list of plays I'm desperate to direct. For me, inspiration comes from context. This play in this place for this audience at this time, that's what I find exciting. And I find programming incredibly exciting and artist support and development incredibly exciting. And those jobs are really demanding. But I remember a long time ago, an AD that I was working with saying to me, look, Kate, no director gets to spend all their time in the rehearsal room. Do you want to spend it hustling for jobs and making connections and building up a portfolio and selling yourself and all of that, which is totally valid? Or do you want to use it building a home? And I just, that's absolutely my bag. I'm happy working with the same people to build a thing that lasts. That's what gets me going. But those jobs are always very busy.
Yeah, but there's a restlessness as well, it seems like, in some sense, or maybe that you seem to have a sense of when it's time to move on as well, because, well, obviously you did move on from the other room and move to what was then Out of Joint. So what kind of prompted that decision?
I didn't intend to move at that point. Like, I wanted to do 6-7 years at the other room and really embed it. But when the job came up, I read the advert and I just went, that's me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought, I have to, because that won't come along again.
Yeah.
And honestly, I felt guilty leaving just under 4 years after setting something up. It wasn't about wanting to leave the other room. It was about wanting to go and do this other thing. And it was the fact it was new writing, the fact it had a national profile, the political values. I don't think I'd have gone for it if I'd have known how hard it was going to be. I mean, I thought I was going into something to run something alongside someone very, very well established who I knew was going to be tricky, but who I thought I could probably find a way to work with, and that it would be about the commissioning and programming of new plays.
Yeah.
I didn't know the touring landscape was going to be so completely blasted and broken. And obviously I didn't know I was going to find myself in the centre of the major Me Too scandal of British theatre 2 weeks into the job.
That was the timing of that for you was just, I mean, brutal, really. I mean, so I think you joined in April 2017. And then I think the public first came to know about the allegations against Max Stafford-Clarke in October, but obviously there were internal kind of discussions before that. So that period of time was tiny. Like, you had not got your feet under the desk before that kicked off.
It was literally 2 weeks into the job.
Insane. And then also I remember talking to you about this a few years ago, and actually the conversation we had has stuck with me so profoundly, actually, about how, I think the phrase that you used was something like, that's not my shame, that the things that he did, that's not my shame. And I found that a really extraordinary and quite kind of profound and mature and extraordinary way to deal with something that could have been completely harrowing and destabilising for a lot of people. Do you remember what it felt like at the time when all that was kicking off?
Yeah, it felt harrowing and destabilising. And you know, it was just relentless. Like, I'm actually really good in a crisis. I kind of rise to the moment, you know, but it just kept coming, you know. First was the complaints and looking after those people, then Max and the board, who were a board that were very much Max's friends and loyalists, and kind of trying to walk them through what that process needed to be fair, and then Rita Sue and Bob too, and taking that over, and, you know, stepping into someone else's creative team, an amazing cast, beautiful people, actually, and going, okay, what's this play? How do I do this? How do I make it? And I just had to, at a certain point, go, I'm going to make it mine. I just have to do my production now. Like, he's not coming back. Yeah. Couldn't tell the company what was going on for ages. Bopping between directing that, having these crisis meetings with the board that were very contentious and difficult and challenging, and also directing Little Voice at Clwyd, because that was my freelance engagement where, you know, because it was one of the things I had in the diary when I got the job, and I was meant to just go there and have a lovely time. And instead, I was literally driving between Mould and Bolton to open both shows at once. And then all the stuff with the Royal Court, which was one of those moments where you just feel like a little ship about to be swallowed up by a very big sea monster, and trying to hold to my values and stand up for what I thought was right. In the face of really brutal, really brutal circumstances.
Really brutal. I mean, just to explain that a bit more for people who don't know about that, lucky them. The play was, so Rita Sue and Bob Too, this absolute kind of touchstone of theatre, but particularly from working class woman's voice. So Andrea Dunbar, extraordinary Andrea Dunbar. And Max Stafford-Clarke was directing a revival of it. These allegations came out and you took over that production, and it was a touring production, but it had a run, and I know you know all this and I'm sorry to make you relive it, had a run scheduled at the Royal Court, which was cancelled, and then after a lot of kind of toing and froing, reinstated. Do you remember, I don't really want to put you back into that period, but do you remember the kind of day-to-day, do you remember how it felt? How did you get through it on a day-to-day, even on an hour-by-hour basis?
Yeah, just, I think I became a bit radicalised about the idea that this play was not about what people thought it was about, and that there was a lot of class prejudice at play. And again, to reiterate, I am middle class, but I'm of a kind of middle class where the world of Rootsu and Bob 2 is not alien to me. And yeah, like, I, you know, I had mates who lived on those estates. I was going off with fellas in cars when I was 15.
Yeah.
But I was dealing with people who thought that it was like an alien planet. And the mixture of humour, the laughs of recognition that were coming from northern working class audiences were very confronting for a lot of people in London theatre. And I think I just got really angry about it. And I loved my cast, and they'd done this massive tour for us, and they understood the play in their bones because they were a working class cast from Yorkshire. And I think we just lent into each other, and we really knew what we wanted to say and what we believed in. But it was, I mean, it was brutal. It was brutal. I still carry some scars from it, I think. I mean, from that whole period out of joint. I mean, because it didn't get any better after that, Tim. You know?
Well, because then COVID hits pretty much straight away, I guess.
Even before that, though, like, it was so hard to get plays on, and it took us ages to realise that people were smiling and telling us that they didn't blame us, but there was no way they wanted our company's name on their posters.
Right, right. So that was that they were, you know, they were tarnishing the company by association. And I guess that, the, you know, it's understandable in some ways because the name of the company was just so synonymous with it, you know, it's found.
Yeah, it was his. Yeah. It was his. And I think, looking back on it, I tried really hard, but I never really found the new identity for the company. I think, you know, the writer's room, stock room, it was a noble experiment, but I don't think ultimately a successful one. And that's no shade on those incredible writers. I think they were amazing. But fundamentally, like, do I believe in that as a way to make theatre long term? I don't think I do. You know, I'm glad that we tried it, and we kept some writers safe and employed during COVID, and we had some fun and we learned some stuff. But I just don't think the company had a future beyond Max in the current climate.
And I think one of the weird, interesting, unique things about theatre is that, you know, there's that inbuilt kind of ephemerality to it. And maybe we're not actually very good at deciding to let things go, at letting things slip into the past. There is a kind of a constant urge to keep things renewed and keep things going. But sometimes that isn't the best thing. It is to let it slip into legacy, I guess. But
yeah, and I think, obviously, I felt this enormous responsibility to keep it going, because I had been instrumental in removing Max, like, not from any careerist ambition or like, it just was what had to happen once the complaints had landed. But I did then feel like, oh God, like, this incredibly important company that is so loved is now my ship to sail, and I didn't want it to die on my watch. That's what used to keep me awake at night. But actually, God, we tried everything.
Yeah.
You know, I tried exciting commissions with new writers that I thought were populist and people loved it, but in the end they didn't program it because they had their own writers under commission. I tried touring known titles, and that worked, but it didn't really justify the company because it wasn't a unique thing.
Yeah, it's so,
you know,
tough.
We
yeah.
tried the writer's room, which was, you know, people liked the idea of it, and they wanted to work with us because we were offering a kind of exciting, new, diverse model of theatre making, but ultimately didn't lead to, you know, it's not how you write The Crucible. And I just think, yeah, looking back, I think I threw myself at the wall for 6 years. And by the end of it, I was extremely bruised and broken. And it, yeah, I'm glad I did it, because I feel like now I'm in the place where I'm meant to be, and I've brought a lot of like hard-earned life experience.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
It's tricky because you can see, you know, so obviously now you are at Clwyd, where a place that, that you have these deep and very loving associations with, and are doing extraordinary things there, and seeing it through it, this redevelopment, and with a fantastic kind of re-inaugural season underway. And in a way, you kind of, I wonder whether you think, well, I have to go through that journey to get here. But then also you're thinking, well, it would have been nice not to have to go through some of the stages of that journey to get here.
For sure. That's exactly how I feel. But I can't regret any of it, because I honestly feel like the luckiest person on the planet. My job is awesome. And for me, it's the pinnacle of everything that I want and wanted to achieve. All of my ambitions now are ambitions for Theatre Clwyd. It's my dream job and I adore it. And it's totally worth it. It's totally worth all of the bloodied noses to get here and work with these incredible people in this amazing place. Like, it's just, yeah, how brilliant.
I can't wait to come back as well. It's such an extraordinary place. I'm so grateful, Kate. This is, it's really, really lovely to talk to you. I'm so excited about what Clwyd is doing. It is a fantastic place. It's an extraordinary place. I don't quite know how it works, but I'm very glad it does.
It's a miracle. It's the miracle on the hill. All
Thanks right. so much for talking to me. Really appreciate
it. It's always a pleasure, Tim. Cheers.
Theatre Voice is an archive of recorded interviews with theatre and performance practitioners. It's held in the V&A's Theatre and Performance Archives, the UK's national collection of performing arts, which are available to consult in the V&A's study rooms.